This is Al Pitcher, and this is a session called How We Can Care for the Earth. This is the first in a series and the last in a series. So it is the series. So I've been here since last September 9th, a year ago, just playing around with the environment, trying to figure out what it's doing and what it's saying to us. And I've developed a whole lot of different ideas about what's happening and what it means. And the first thing that I think it means is I think God is saying something to us through the creation, through the physical, chemical, biological world. God is saying something to us. And that led me to look at the Old Testament, and here and there in the Old Testament, in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, in Jeremiah, you find whoever wrote down those words saying that God is saying to the people of Israel, you have abandoned me, you have worshipped idols, and I will take away the rain, I will take away your crops, I will devastate the whole natural world for you. And it's unbelievable to find it all there. It's been there all the time, but it's there. And so what is more and more entering my soul is the conviction that God is saying no to a great deal of what Western civilization is about. And God is saying that no by virtue of letting. That's a very slippery term, but not stopping, except insofar as the structure of the creation is saying no. And insofar as that's God's creation, it's going to say no. And we can hope somehow that that no will turn into a yes. But just like the whole history of the Bible is a very, very slippery back and forth between mercy and judgment. Judgment comes. The temple is destroyed. I really believe that we are destroying the creation. We are destroying the creation. Western civilization is destroying the creation. What we do every day of our lives contributes to the destruction of the creation. We have a lifestyle that is destroying the creation. And I don't know how you feel about it, but that's where I'm at. Now, you may be in a quite different spot. And I'm not going to take a lot of time today to develop the thesis, that is, to develop the basis for this, but I will show a few things which indicate why I think this is so. Because if we don't start there, then we're never going to end in the same place. That is to say, where we start will determine where we end. This is the projected energy use at the top. It just shows you that one projection shows not too much difference by 2020. And the other two projections show about a doubling of energy by 2020. That's 30 years. But what I'm interested in is the global warming and energy use. I'm assuming we're all aware that the chief problem in energy use is the fact the energy is created by fossil fuels, by coal and oil and gas. And the fossil fuels, in burning the fossil fuels, carbon dioxide is given off. Carbon dioxide goes up in the atmosphere, forms a blanket, and that blanket lets the sunlight in and keeps the energy waves, the infrared energy waves, from getting out. It's like some of these windows where you can see out, but you can't see in. Well, in this case, these gases let the heat in, or let the sunlight in, but they don't let the energy out. So it creates a greenhouse effect, creates a warming. And the carbon dioxide on Venus is many times what it is in our atmosphere, and Venus is 800 degrees. 800 degrees on the surface of Venus.
Would you explain that why it is, I guess I missed the whole point. Why you can see more in the second cylinder there, why you can see more of the earth? Is that because the ozone's gone or something? I can't see the titles. They're all blurry.
Oh, these are just two different, these are three different projections of how much energy we're going to use by, and the energy is water, nuclear, biomass, coal, gas, and oil. And so the layers are in terms of the different kinds of energy that will be used. And you can see in the projections of high energy use that the black extends, and both the coal and the oil extend. Although oil will last through 2030. Oil probably won't last through the next century. I mean, 60 years, maybe 70 years. You know, there are about 1,000 billion barrels of oil in the world that we know about. Maybe say that has half again as much. But we're using 24 billion barrels a year. So 24 billion barrels, and you've got 1,000 billion barrels, you've only got, 45 years worth of oil. Given that, and double it, then you might have, at the present rate, without the increase of use of oil, at the present rate, you would have at most 90 years of oil. Oil is gone. It's just gone.
What about natural gas?
Natural gas is a little better. A little better. You might have twice as much natural gas. And there's all kinds of coal. But the oil is gone for practical purposes. You've got to figure that your great-grandchildren or your grandchildren will not have oil unless they make oil from coal. But the problem is that whether you make oil from coal or whatever you do, whenever you burn a hydrocarbon, whenever you burn coal or gas or oil, you create this carbon dioxide, which warms up the earth. The bottom picture shows you the projections of how much the earth is going to be warm. If we cut our fossil use in half by 2075, the earth will warm from 3 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit. If we cut all our gas, oil, and coal in half, that is what we're using now. If we cut it in half, if we cut the energy use from these sources in half, then we will still get that kind of warming. And that's considerable warming according to all the studies I've seen, all the interpreters I've seen. 5 degrees is a great deal of warming. That's the average temperature in the earth. If we use the present amount of energy, it will warm from 5 to 15 degrees. And if we continue to use energy at the rate of growth projected in those two barrels on the right hand at the top, that kind of energy increase, it will warm from 10 to 30 degrees. So if it were, 122 in Phoenix, it would be 132, 142, 152, 152 degrees maybe in Phoenix during the summer. And that would, from all practical purposes, that is almost an impossible life situation. If this doesn't make sense to us, then we are not considering what's happening to the creation. Now, carbon dioxide is only half of the global warming. It's about 50% of the global warming. But we have other gases that also, the chlorofluorocarbons, which destroy the ozone, are also global warming gases. And the carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere about 100 years. So there's nothing you can do to, I mean, for 100 years we have in the atmosphere what we have right now, and some of the carbon dioxide isn't up there, and we have all the chlorofluorocarbons that we have right now, and it takes from 7 to 15 years to get up there. So all the chlorofluorocarbons for the last 7 to 15 years are on their way up there. But they're somewhere between 20 to 25% of the global warming problem. They not only destroy the ozone, which keeps the ultraviolet rays from coming, but they also create this warming effect. And methane is another gas from all the disintegration of biomass, of florists, and it also comes out of the stomach of animals, methane, and it comes from all of our waste fills. Now, some places they're now collecting that methane and burning it. But when you have a waste fill that doesn't, you are letting that methane go up, and it's another warming gas. Well, what if it warms? I'm convinced it's going to get warmer.
Do they have a substitute for carbon? Air conditioning is one of the main problems, is that it?
Air conditioning and refrigeration. It's in all our refrigerators, all our air conditioning. You let an old refrigerator go to the dump and all that stuff escapes. You let anybody fix your air conditioner who doesn't recycle the air conditioning material, the chlorofluorocarbons in the, and you again will...
They don't have the substitute yet.
Well, they have some substitutes, but they're more expensive. They have one substitute which is much less contributory. It's got a hydrogen atom in it. For some reason or other, the hydrogen atom makes all that difference. There's a different chemical formula. But one of the real problems is the third world, in a sense, can't afford. So the present arrangement is for the third world to phase out its chlorofluorocarbons by 2010 and not use them anymore. And theoretically, we won't use ours. But of course, we manufacture them now and send them to the third world. It's really ironic. If I can keep these things straight here, take us a step further. In terms of the effect of warming, and these are all estimates. The scientists differ, and there are all kinds of factors involved in whether the oceans are going to expand or whether the temperature is going to expand. The heat from the sun changes, the curvature of the orbit changes, amount of water vapor in the air changes, and water vapor will keep the sun from coming in. So if it gets warmer, there's a different amount of absorption rates of carbon dioxide in the ocean. So I don't mean to make this simple, but there's kind of a simple correlation between the amount of fossil fuels we burn or the amount of biomass that's burned, that is forests that are burned in any kind of vegetation that's burned, and the warming. But I probably read people who are prejudiced toward interpretation which says that the warming has started. This shows you five studies on the effect on the oceans. And this is in centimeters. So 100 centimeters is a yard, so 100 centimeters is it's a little 39 inches actually, so it's a little over a yard. So 70 centimeters would be about two-thirds of a yard, so you got a couple of feet maybe. And it goes from 2 feet to about 10 feet, 368 centimeters. So varying estimates of what's going to happen to the ocean. But clearly, if it gets warmer, the ocean will expand, and if it gets warmer, the ice will melt if it gets warmer. And everything that I've read indicates that it's going to get warmer. And this is somewhere in the range of what's going to happen to the ocean. My daughter just bought a piece of property with her husband and another couple on the Pacific Ocean in British Columbia, 7 acres. And their doorstep, I think, is about 8 feet above the ocean. It was all I could do not to say anything about it. I just read all this stuff. You know, it's not only the ocean rising, but it's the storms and the waves and the hurricanes that they predict. That the with the temperature differential greater between the pole and the equator, they say the wind currents will be greater and there'll be more hurricanes. And, who knows? It is clear, however, that we are, by human action, significantly changing the conditions under which we operate. And it's clear to me from my studies that there is a direct correlation between the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the temperature on the Earth. There's a direct correlation, and I could give you that that history of a, if I can find it here, 160,000 years in which the correlation has held. Well, I don't know how much I really announce this as dealing with what we should do about it, what we can do to save the creation. But I think we have to kind of start the same place. What have I got here? Nope, still haven't got it. First one is 160,000 years, and you can see that there's almost direct correlation between the amount of carbon dioxide and the average temperature. And what they've done is to bore down into the ice in the Arctic zones and then analyze the bubbles of air that are caught in the ice and get the amount of carbon dioxide. They analyze the temperature. Estimate the temperature by sediments, by the kind of pollen that they find in the sediments in some of the lake bottoms. And the bottom is the last, since 1860, 130 years, showing the correlation. So, now this is only global warming. If we move on to think of some of the other problems, and I'll just deal briefly with, well, I did want to show you how much carbon we use in North America. About 5 tons per person. In the world is about 1.42. That we are responsible for, I think it's now about 22% of the carbon that's released in the world. Five tons. Per person, that's you know, that's It seems like a great deal.
What's it made up of, once a year?
Well, it's made up of energy production, about 35% from the production of electricity, and it's made up of commercial and industrial use of energy, and it's made up of home use, and it's made up of transportation. Home use is not a big part of it, but transportation and commercial and industrial and electricity production. Of course, we use electricity in our homes, but for heating homes, it's about 7%. So that those are roughly 30 to 40%, those three big categories. So to what is affected is all industrial production, all transportation, and all electricity use, if we're going to reduce the this just, I've got it right here. Someday I'll get these right. This shows the same thing, amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The increase of it. Well, ozone is being destroyed, and the chlorine is from the fluorocarbons, the chlorine. Chlorine and bromine are the chief culprits in the destruction of ozone. Ozone is O3, and the chlorine acts as a catalytic agent and destroys the O3, and then it in the process forms a chlorine compound, and the chlorine compound breaks down and the chlorine is then there. So the one atom of chlorine, they say, affects about 120,000 atoms of ozone. And the ozone prevents the ultraviolet ray B2 from getting to the Earth. And again, you've got a delicate balance in nature. That's the thing that's amazing. That you have this delicate balance, that ozone is up there, that it prevented, for years and years and years, it's prevented this ultraviolet B2 from reaching the Earth, and it's made life possible, and the whole development of life is due to that condition which we're now destroying. So that the natural background, you see the low level that's existed for thousands of years, and at Montreal they agreed to reduce the levels of chlorofluorocarbons, and agreed to reduce them about 70%. And the contention now is they simply have to be eliminated. So it says if it's not strengthened, chlorine levels will reach 12 parts per billion by 2100, line one. So every day that we have the chlorofluorocarbons, we are likely to do what this article says. The danger is on a scale almost too large to grasp. The Environmental Protection Agency has predicted that if nothing were done to save the ozone layer, increased ultraviolet radiation caused between 163 billion and 308 million extra cases of skin cancer among Americans living today and born by 2075. Some 3.5 to 6.5 million of these cases would be fatal. And that is just in the United States. And we're about 4.6% of the population. Now, the darker skin people are not as subject. So that the darker your skin, the less likely you are to get this cancer. Around the world, there would be more than 1 or 2 billion additional cases of skin cancer over the same period. Also cause millions of cataracts and possibly serious immunological disorders. Enormous damage would be done to the natural environment, raising from billions of dollars in reduced crop yields to the potential collapse of the marine food chain. They've experimented with the ultraviolet rays with phytoplankton, which is the kind of base of the food chain in the ocean, and it is very destructive. Increase of 1 or 2% is an increase of 10 to 15% of decline in the growth of phytoplankton.
Is there an area in the United States where it's less? What does it vary?
It varies with the latitude.
Somewhere
in the stuff here, I've got a map of the latitudes and. I don't know. The fact is that the Antarctic, there's a hole some parts of the year. There isn't any. And in Tasmania, between 83 and 88, the incidence of skin cancer increased 8%. And Tasmania, of course, is down closer to the hole. And the theory is that closer to the hole you are, the less ozone. And I don't know.
I understand that Morbillus, which is, I understand, also caused by sun exposure in the Columbia Basin than there is in the rest of the state, and meaning on down toward Spokane. And I'm beginning to wonder now if that could somehow be associated with.
I do not know. I don't have even a glimmer of a thesis. They say it's as big as the United States, at least the continent. Of course, it'd be bigger, but at any rate, it seems to me that the evidence is almost incontrovertible that our activities are at least threatening the whole basis for human existence, human activity. Lifestyle, what we do to produce things is threatening the possibility of human life. And then we could go on to the destruction of soils and the prediction of how long the topsoils will last because of our agricultural policies. I mean, it's the same sort of a problem that if you have certain agricultural policies with certain rotation of crops, your topsoil will increase. If you have others, it will decrease. And our methods are certainly decreasing the topsoil and allowing it to be eroded. And, in some countries, it's much worse than ours. And in the third world, because of the third world economic situation, forests are being destroyed, and in Costa Rica, for example, they have 17% of their original forests left. And in the Amazon in 1980, they released the atmosphere with the burning of the forest 337 million tons of carbon dioxide, so that it's a dual thing, because the trees take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and if you burn the trees, they release the carbon dioxide, and you don't have the trees to take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. One power company just agreed to plant, several hundred thousand trees in return for the right, I don't know whether they had to do it, but they did it for starting a new power plant. We should be planting billions of trees. But that gets us into policy, and that's another aspect of it. And the population explosion means that the trees around the world are being destroyed in order for the people to have land to farm. And that's partly due to the economic policies of the third world. And this, just to give you a flavor of what it means to listen to all this stuff, here is the seven African countries, and the prediction about the disparity between the amount of food just to keep life going is in these countries is 9.3 million, and the fuel disparity is 10 million people. So that and the third world countries are increasing in population. We're increasing our population. We're doubling our population every 38 years, and about 95% of that is in these countries where they have this fuel and fuel disparity, and where the trees are being cut down, and and so they won't have the fuel for it shows that the loss of tropical forests in this 32-year span. So it's 50%, 56%, 52% were lost during that time.
In the Scandinavian countries, like in Germany, some of those famous burger trees cut down, they have to plant the tree. Yeah. Seems like I've heard that someplace.
Yeah.
So don't we have a planting, tree planting?
As far as I know, we have no national policy with regard to treatment. The Forest Department, I don't know what the Forest Department actual policy is, but we certainly don't have any major tree replanting program. Now, some states are putting it on the ballot. All I want to say is here is that we are destroying our food. I mean, this shows some of the leading pesticides. It was a study, and it shows what residues were found on certain products, vegetables and fruits. And then it makes some attempt to say what you can do about it to get rid of those residues. And these charts include the five pesticides detected most frequently in each fruit vegetable by the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and California monitoring programs. Some pesticides said to be particularly harmful cannot be detected by the methods that were used, so they do not appear. And I'll just run through these. I don't want to make a big deal of it, except I guess I do want you to be aware of the fact that what we are doing to ourselves covers the lot. It's just not a matter of the global warming or the ozone or the toxic wastes, the poisons in our water, the poisons in the air, the pollutions, the poisons on our food. Well, I use Shackley's Basic H.
Oh, okay. You wondered about Shackley's Basic H.
And now I've started peeling, I swear. I ate a pear yesterday without peeling it. I was so frustrated peeling that last pear I ate. But once you get into this stuff, you say to yourself, it's like the bumper sticker, you know, watch your diet, eat carefully, and die anyway. But,
I know I came home from California just feeling frustrated in the kitchen.
Well, you know, I think we got to grow our own food. And
but
we.
To
and
grow
we,
our own food, we had a problem where we live because you can't get an apple that you can eat if you don't spray it, you know.
Well, then, I've decided that I probably won't eat some food anymore. I'll eat bananas. Now, bananas you can take off the peel easily. That's my fruit of the future. Mm-hmm. Bananas and oranges and grapefruit, they seem to think.
How about you have to
transport
them long distance?
Oh, I know. That's the other problem. You can't win, of course. You can't win. Well, that's enough of that junk. That's enough. I'm just buried in it. I haven't brought half of it down here. But what I'm saying to you is that we have to listen. That's really what I want to say to you. We have to listen to what the earth and the creation is saying to us. And that's all I've been doing for a year. I have done nothing else, almost 7 days a week. It's just read the stuff, listen to it, listen. And at all kinds of levels, at very superficial levels, at very general levels, textbook on global warming and textbook on ozone, stuff that's more complicated, but listen. And listen to the debates that go on. We need to listen. And I say it sinks into our soul that God is really saying something to us. And I'm simply amazed. I've been here a year, and I sometimes think I haven't had any effect on what's going on here at all. I was at the table this morning and I was talking to somebody about, I wasn't going to eat meat. I don't know where we got off. Are you a vegetarian? Somebody said, no, I said, I just don't eat meat. And we got in a discussion why I say I don't eat meat. I said, well, it just takes too much energy. You know, it takes 15 times as much energy to produce an ounce of energy food value in beef as it does if you eat a grain, 15 times as much. Every bit of that energy sends that carbon dioxide up in the air. And I know that my not eating meat, you know, is no great big deal. It doesn't affect the world much. And if I hadn't gone to Ashland recently, I would have saved so much more in terms of that carbon dioxide. My wife wanted to go to Ashland for the Shakespeare plays, so we went to Ashland. But every single thing you use, you buy anything. And it takes energy, and all that energy is produced by, for the most part, we got a little in the water, you know, people in Washington can say, well, we got so much hydropower. We're not quite so bad here. But all that electricity that is manufactured by hydropower could go into another system in a neighboring state without hydropower, so they wouldn't have to use their fossil fuels. So you can't win. There's no way to get out of the fact that every time you use any energy, you are sending up that carbon dioxide and warming. You buy anything, you eat anything. I guess if you ate stuff you grew yourself, I still don't know whether you could get away from using some energy. But the point is, our whole society is just built upon this massive, massive use of energy. How to get off of this? Anyway, I felt that some people were simply amazed that that there was some connection between eating food and carbon dioxide.
And you're so right, though, because if you did it and I did it, should we do it? First thing you know, we've got many people to, and then we need to do it.
Well, you know, I stopped eating meat when I read somewhere that if 10% of Americans would eat grain instead of meat, that it would save 12 million bushels of, or 12 million tons, I don't know what it was. It must have been 12 million tons of grain a year. And that was enough to feed the rest of the world. I don't know whether it's enough to feed the rest of the world. I know it's not going to go to the rest of the world because we stopped eating it. But still, that just hit me. Well, why do? Why not? But it's symbolic mostly, I think. I mean, and I'll get into the reason why such acts are symbolic, because the energy that's used is primarily in other areas, and it's not completely in other areas, but so much of it is in other areas that there are other things to do. So what I've been trying to say is we should use less fossil fuels, less gasoline, less heat, less oil, less wood, less things. And so we should, in order to get ourselves caring for the earth, I think we have to listen. And that's why this book, State of the World, is a good book to read, or this program, if you're going to be out getting October 4th on national public television stations, will be based on this State of the World. It will help you listen. And not only you listen, but to get other people to listen. I think we should start listening ourselves and find a way to help other people listen. So the care for the earth means to listen. That's the first thing. It means to listen and to get other people to listen, to get groups in your church. When I get back, we will have a task force in our church on energy. They've already had some meetings, but it's in lethargy. And we will listen, and we will begin to figure out what we can do, and we will make an inventory of our church. We will, like we did at Holden, we took a whole afternoon here and went over the whole life of Holden, and what we were doing, what we could be doing, what more we could be doing, and we will try to get our people who are in other institutions to do the same thing. Now, I just got back from Cottage Grove, and one of my former kind of colleagues is in Cottage Grove. He's been working on energy. They have a local energy company that buys gas from energy from Bonneville, electricity, 2.5 cents a kilowatt, and distribute it. I got a thing like this on energy conservation that they put out to help their people. That company, this person who's related to this company, good Presbyterian, is able, through that company, they fought tooth and nail to get that company, but they now have control, and so they can use that situation to get energy efficient use. I just read about Osage, Iowa, where the power company took the lead in this, and they cut the energy cost $1,000 a household in that little town because somebody took the initiative. Somebody felt that this caring for the creation was an imperative. And it's good business, too, I guess. at least it seemed to be in that town, businesses are now coming to the town, according to this report, because the energy costs are lower.
That was in the state of Iowa.
It was Iowa, Sage, Iowa. So I don't know any alternative. This will not get into your soul, I think, by reading the newspaper and that. So maybe it will, but it certainly didn't get in my soul that way. I really had to read a few books and think about it and work on it a little. And I hadn't done anything about it. I was so out of the world that when a farm that seven of us owned planted 14,000 trees, I didn't even have one little minute or second of joy because we were taking that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. I was so unrelated to what is going on, and I think a lot of our people are really unrelated to the whole cycle and the whole reality that is the seriousness of this. And I think we in the church, as I've said partly with my tongue and my cheek, we need to become thrice-born Christians, and the thrice-born Christian is the one who really is in love with the creation, who is identified with the creation and the structure of the creation which supports life. And it's the Christ who is the second person of the Trinity, if you want to get theological, and it's the Christ who is the very principle of the creation, through whom and in whom and everything has its being. And I think we're entering a new age in which this attention to the creation will be the focus of a reformation in our church life. And it will bring life, I guarantee you. If you get a group paying attention to this, it will bring life to your church. I know it can be done. I've done it with the Central American group that in our church, where we simply began to attend to it and connect with people and go down there and have a sister church. And we've got the assistant, the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador, out of our group now. You can't believe what happened in the life of that church because we attended to something seriously. So I'm saying this issue is so much more universal in terms of its effect on us than Central America. You've got to jazz up that a little to get some people to get interested in Central America. But I think this is a matter of life and death for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren and for... Let me just give you the significance of it. The population of Mexico is supposed to go from 73 billion, which it was last year, to 187 million before it levels off. Why is it going there? Partly because of the economic conditions of the Mexican country, where all kinds of theories about how you get control of your population. There are four steps, according to everything I've read. You give women status, you give them education, you give them economic opportunity, and you give the whole country, the poor people, economic opportunity, and you give them birth control. That's five steps. 5 points, and it will shift, they say. And it has shifted in some countries. Well, that has to be done, and we got to take... But think of what the Rio Grande is going to be with 187 million Mexicans. Think of what California is going to be like with 187 million Mexicans.
And Eastern Washington.
Eastern Washington. This, my friends, is not something far off. And part of it is our way of life and what we've done in third world countries and what we're proposing to do with the global market. Which global market will reinforce the third world countries creating for the market, not for their own life, not for their own health, not for the education of their people and the increased status of the poorer people. It will redound to the economic welfare of the ruling elites in these third world countries. You know, 2% of the people in El Salvador own 60% of the land, and it's a good land. And El Salvador will continue to increase in population, to continue to be a mess,
till somehow we can help in that situation. So third world economic development is a very crucial part of saving the creation, of caring for the creation. And if you get into the species destruction, 10,000 species are destroyed a year by destroying the tropical forest. The tropical forest become the place where two things happen. One, cattle ranching, the cattle ranching for export, and the poor people can be fed into this and got off the back of the government because they're now in the big cities. And if they can open up these forest regions and get the people out there. The Amazon is opened up, and it's a disaster, as far as I can see. All these are interpretations. You understand it. It's a year's worth of focus a little bit of previous work on some of this stuff, but for the most part, it's a year's work of focus. I did work on the energy in the 70s and wrote a program for the United States, participated in the National Council stuff. But generally speaking, I'm a Johnny-come-lately. All I've done for a year is listen. And I just want to, we're running out of time. Helping others listen, I think we have to have these study groups. All these books, there are hundreds of books. But State of the World, there's another book, Managing Planet Earth, put out by Scientific American. That lays out the basic issues. Everybody ought to read one of those two books without exception and get the general thrust of what's happening to our creation. And there are all kinds of children's books. There's that one with the right title there, which is a children's book. We ought to get our children working on this. There ought to be a task force in every single church. Every single church ought to have a group attending to this. And then our own lifestyles are going to be affected, and I don't know much more that I can say about that. I have a problem buying anything now. And it's a great contradiction to have the bookstore here with all the stuff for people to sell. I mean to buy, when you know that the buying of anything is part of the problem, and a whole lifestyle that depends upon having the things and using the energy and depending on the cars. I went down to Cottage Grove to look at a community that was supposed to be down there, a relatively self-sufficient community of about 2,000 people, started about 20 years ago. It's not a possibility. But one of the leaders of the German Green Party says that's what we ought to be creating, is relatively self-sufficient communities which don't need cars, which grow their own food and do a lot of their own work, and which take care of their own education. And you have public transportation, and you have cars maybe that can be rented for special occasions and things. And you're working within your community. I don't know whether that's a possibility, but energy efficiency, I can show you a slide in which you could save from $20 to $70 by putting one efficient shower head. One efficient shower head. You could save $20 if you use gas, $70 if you use electricity, and you not only save the money, but you save the energy that heats the water. Which saves the carbon dioxide. Just one little shower head. And some of you probably know that I've gotten all this stuff. And if you haven't picked one of these up, here's another one on 128 things to do to save the earth. And, there's 750, there are 1,000, there will probably be someone with 5,000. There's the Utney Reader came out with 50 difficult things now to do. And, they put out 50 simple things. It's 50 simple things for kids to do. I mean, everybody's getting into the game and making money out of it, and I don't care if they make money, because if somehow we move into energy efficiency, and You can produce a house now that uses practically no electricity. I saw a house in Cottage Grove. It's practically no heat whatsoever. Clean air. Then we ought to begin to relate to what I call the green, well, it's called the Green Committees of Correspondence, like this Revolutionary War period when we had committees of correspondence. The Clean Air Bill, we ought to have a Clean Air Bill that's much tougher. I don't know whether what happened to the one that was just in. We ought to have a carbon tax so that we wouldn't use, so we would use efficient. We ought to have cars that got 60, 70 miles a gallon. We can do it. We got the technology. We ought to have standards for our cars. We started to have standards. We've got we raised miles per gallon, about 12 miles per gallon. We ought to have standards for appliances. I can show you a slide which shows that California, which introduced a program of energy efficiency in 76, uses half the energy per person that Texas does in California because they ask for energy-efficient appliances. They set standards, and they've got a whole program for standards for appliances, and you can get almost up to 100% saving in energy. And we ought to, and they did the same thing for new buildings. Where we work, we could do the same thing. Some of us, I think, could really begin to listen and begin to relate to these issues full time. I think it's a calling. I think it's the greatest missionary calling that I've ever heard of, is to save the creation.
And he had learned from a publication sent out by the U.S. government to the schools, and the teacher had really put it forth to the solution.
Oh, that's...
He thought this 8-year-old and all 8-year-olds in that school district grow up, and remember this, remember 1/3 of it, the impact they would have. So.
Well, I don't know. It's 5 o'clock, and you may want to say a word or two. I'm too full of this.
You haven't said anything about political action. And I think that has to be already.
Yeah, that was the meaning of the green committees of correspondence are politically oriented. Or,
but and, I mean, your church would have to become politically active because if everybody doesn't write in and get something done and make them know that you mean it, you're not going to do it.
Well,
I listened to a program, I believe it was McNeil there, shortly before we came, talking ahead, interviewing one of the fellows from General Motors, telling how impossible it was to raise the gasoline mileage. They'd done just about as much as they could do. And so forth and so on and so forth, and that people wanted the bigger cars. And like you said, this other fellow said it's the same story with the last energy crisis.
Yeah.
It was that they couldn't possibly do it. Now they're saying the same thing again.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that industry is in some cases really seemingly the culprit. But I just have to say that some industry isn't, and that's why I used those two illustrations. I don't know how it happened. I haven't got the full story of it, but I know how it happened in Cottage Grove. I mean, some people just went after that and put it on the ballot until the ballot somehow got them the in charge of this energy distribution system, and now they have the control and can institute what they want. And the reason there's so many people in Cottage Grove is because they were attracted by this community of 2,000 people. They came to do it, and it became a mess and didn't work out. But a lot of them are still in Cottage Grove. So you have that spirit. It can be done. The spirit. That spirit can really begin to change things.
Is that a very recent development down there, or is it that you started the first energy
crisis? They took over this company, I think, in 82. But they had worked on it. It came out of the last energy crisis. I mean, the impetus for it came, I'm sure. But I may be wrong about 82, it may be 85. It's not a long, long way back that they got control of the distribution.
Well, what is it? A planned community where people are within walking distance of their...
That was the idea. This is just an energy distribution company. The idea of the community didn't work out. It didn't work out for various reasons. But in my own mind, that's where I'm headed. I'm probably too old to start that thing. We have an intentional Christian community in Chicago of 70 people. So I know what it takes to create a community. And our problem is we only got a 22-flat building. We don't have the land. We don't have the economic base. We don't have, I want 5,000 acres. And then I think we could begin to create a situation in which... The whole purpose of the community. Now, how are you going to do this? I don't know how you're going to create a new ethos with a television.